Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's B-Y-T-E.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Everyone, welcome to Martinis and Murder.
Listen to that enthusiasm.
You
win the enthusiasm award every week, Darren.
I'm Miss Congeniality, you know that. Come
That's
on now.
That's true. I'm so excited because by the time this episode airs,
yes,
the Golden State Killer will have been sentenced. Isn't that a fun thing to say?
Right. So that is such a fun thing to say. I loved our update last week. I hope that you at least started I'll Be Gone in the Dark or have made it on your list. But that means that next Sunday, or maybe even another shot, we'll be able to like fully talk about it and just keep giving updates on this. So
absolutely. I'm just so excited that justice is going to be served, you know?
Well, I think there's so many people I think that can't wait for this. And just like Michelle McNamara's work alone, I think, deserves some sort of justice, let alone all the horrible, just the victims of his family, as well as all of the victims that were a result of his. Like, it's so important that these people get justice, so I'm excited for that.
Yeah, well, obviously make sure you guys are updated. Darren, are you drinking anything this week? Because I wanted to start with letting you know that my allergies are in full effect, as they are every year at this time. So I'm just drinking water in hopes that it will help, you know, flush my system, so to speak.
I think vodka flushes your system a lot more than water does.
Oh, is that right? Well, yes. If I had some here, I might have some, but I don't.
Okay, John. I mean, last week, someone made fun of you because you were like, oh my God, I'm drinking a Syrah. Oh my God, I love wine. Oh my God, I don't have a wine opener.
Well, and also I said, didn't I say like Syrah instead of Syrah, which I don't know why I said that. I know what Syrah is.
Because you love wine so much.
I love
that
wine,
you were so
guys.
Drunk while this was going on that you just couldn't take it.
Exactly. And thank you, everybody, for roasting me in the Facebook group. Always, always nice to see our friends.
I am going to have a lovely glass of rosé. I am in the Hamptons right now, and nothing says summer in the Hamptons like a glass of rosé.
I love rosé. I miss having... I feel like we have rosé every summer. Like, we're always in some weird little NBC digital meeting, and we're, like, cheersing with rosé. I don't know if that's true or not, but
I miss our summer parties together. That's what I miss. Those Bravo Oxygen summer parties.
I know. Well, listen, I'll be back sometime in the next couple of weeks, so hopefully we can have, like, a social distance... you know, cheers, bitch, basically.
I would love it. Should we get into the case this week?
Yes, and I also want to mention that Matt is once again MIA. I don't know if he even still works on the show.
I'm not confident he's still on the podcast, to be fair.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like he just, like, gave up on life. Like, he gave up on this, like we all gave up on 2020. Yeah. We're the 2020 of podcasts to Matt.
Exactly. And by the way, by Matt, we also do mean Touch Woman 7. So let's just be clear about that.
Well, I will say the odd thing is like when we were waiting in the Skype group to talk to we were actually waiting for you today, John, which is shocking I was earlier than you, which never happens.
I was 1 minute late and everyone's like, where's John?
Well, I was like very concerned. just we didn't know. I mean, even Matt was on there. And so usual, my thing is Touch Woman 7000 is here. That's me. And then Matt, I was expecting Matt to be here. And then we were like, "Where's John? Where's John?" And Megan aptly said, "Probably not touch woman seven out there. Like, probably not doing anything like that." And I died laughing. And then, of course, you came on 2 seconds later, being like, "Here I am, not touching women anywhere." And
yeah,
I was like,
that's me.
I was very proud of you for that one.
Not at all. Yep, not at all. Let's get into this week's episode, Darren.
Let us do it. This one takes place in Blairsville, Pennsylvania. I have never been to Blairsville.
I haven't been, but I know where it is, and I have friends that live near there. So that kind of is a connection to
the case.
Is it
near Pittsburgh?
Yeah, it's somewhat near Pittsburgh, yeah.
Okay, well, here we go. Well, in the afternoon of April 13th, 2006, which was right before I graduated high school.
Oh, gosh, wow.
I know, sorry. You were a sophomore in college?
Yep, I was.
I was a wee high schooler then. Well, in the sleepy town of Blairsville, Pennsylvania, wow, a young boy walked up to his neighbor's house and made a horrific discovery. No good story can start like this.
No, never.
Like, that doesn't seem fun. Like, you know, horrific. So on his neighbor's house, the front door window is broken and there's blood all over the porch. He looks through the window and sees bare feet.
Isn't that a weird image to, like, put in your head, like, looking through a broken, bloody window and seeing bare feet?
This is like we were talking about Tales from the Crypt last week.
That's right.
And I was like, this is the start of it. So the boy runs home to tell his grandfather and uncle, who return to the house to see a horrific scene of blood everywhere, and they call 911. Michael Fuoco, a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, said that veteran homicide investigators describe the scene as one of the most gruesome they've ever seen. Senior Deputy Attorney General Anthony Krastek told Oxygen's Killer Affair, quote, "This was clearly a very violent homicide. The victim had numerous wounds, slashing wounds, obviously knife wounds. There was so much blood that it went through the floor and went into the basement below." I mean, for someone to describe any scene as the more horrific crime scene, most gruesome they've ever seen, like, especially coming out of Pittsburgh, I imagine that's got to be bad. But, like, the imagery of all this blood that's seeping through the floor, I mean, that's a lot of blood.
I know. So investigators quickly realized that something had gone through the glass panel of the front door. Inside of the house, there were fingerprints, smudges, smears, and papers that were overturned, which indicated to investigators that a fight of some sort had gone down. This is like maybe my favorite part of our show, where they look at the crime scene, they kind of make all these assertions, I guess you could say, based on what they see.
Sure.
And it's just amazing. Like, they can just walk in, they take a look, and they're like, ah, yes, this was clearly a fight, or this was, you know, this or that. I just find that stuff so interesting. The most obvious clue was a trail of bloody shoe prints on the floor. Since the victim was found barefoot, investigators needed to analyze the prints in case they belonged to the killer. Because, if the victim's laying on the floor without shoes and there are shoe prints, then that's a pretty good indication that there's more than one person involved. And because there was so much blood all through the house and the hallways, the killer's shoe prints led down the hallway and back out of the back door. Uh-huh. So they had a pretty clear path here. This is very, like... By the way, in my opinion, doing all these shows, Darren, like, this is somebody that's obviously not smart enough to cover their tracks literally.
You know, right. It seems to me that it happened quickly, a get-in, get-out situation.
Yeah, well, it seemed obvious to the investigators that the killer came through the back door, through the kitchen, through the dining room, and then into the living room. The victim was identified as beloved 39-year-old dentist John Jelinek. When talking to John's neighbors, many of them recalled horrific sounds coming from the house.
Oof.
Yeah, and Krastek said, quote, "Various neighbors heard noises, screams that they reported. These screams were almost like an animal being slaughtered, blood-curdling screams that were that's how they were described," end quote.
This is like Silence of the Lambs when he's talking about, Jodie Foster's talking about her dream and just like the silent slaughtering and just like,
Yeah, and the scream started well after midnight, rousing neighbors from their sleep, but no one saw anything or called 911, which I find very odd. Like, if you have neighbors that are that close and hearing screams, I mean...
Blood-curdling screams, I would be calling 911, or at least, try and see what was up.
Yeah, well, based on more of the evidence with the investigation, police were able to determine when the murder happened and were able to get a general time frame of around 1 a.m. And police couldn't help but wonder who in the small town would want to kill this guy and do it in such a violent manner. Police knew they needed help finding answers, but in Blairsville, Pennsylvania, there had been no recent homicides in recent memory, so this was their introduction, Darren, to a homicide investigation.
I mean, to some extent, you're like, that's great that there were no homicides beforehand. Right, you're not ruining for homicides, but at the same time, it also sounds like... You know, you do need experience sometimes to catch these cases and solve them. So we'll see how this turns out.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things I remember when we interviewed Francie Hakes way back in the day, and I talk about this from time to time. I love her, right?
I love her.
Is that one of the things I just remember kind of coming to realize from her interview is that not every police department has the same resources. And this police department had never had a homicide investigation before. It shocked the community. And now they're faced with a monumental task of trying to find a killer. I mean, that's pretty big. That's a lot to handle if you don't have the resources. And we'll find out later on in this episode how important that specific detail is. Because the Pennsylvania State Police were called in to assist, they meticulously scoured the scene for DNA evidence and photographed the footprints of blood splatter and stab wounds on the victim's body. Krastek noted, quote, "There are slashing wounds across the body. We can tell from that the perpetrator had a large, sturdy knife."
I mean, that just makes me think of like a big kitchen knife.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
You know.
Yeah. And they could see by the sheer number of vicious wounds that this wasn't just a quick or accidental killing, right? Like, obviously, with so many
blood. Yeah, right, yeah. Exactly.
And Fuoco, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter, said, quote, "This was a frenzied murder. There was a tremendous amount of anger both in the choice of the weapon and what was done with that weapon," end quote. Another thing I feel like we've learned on the show, it's like you can determine intent by the crime scene, usually.
Well, good point. I mean, there's certainly a difference, even though a death is a death, you know, there certainly is a difference between maybe one stab wound that's effective and 49, yeah. Maybe not right. As effective, but certainly I think the passion, and I mean that in a pejorative sense, behind that type of killing is really important to telling the story of who killed whom.
I completely agree. Krastek also commented about this on Killer Affair, saying, quote, "This was not some burglary. There were no drawers that were pulled out. Nobody went upstairs or downstairs looking for drugs or money. This was a crime of passion. So who hated John Jelinek?" End quote. Before investigators could begin digging for answers, they needed to inform John's family about his death. Court records indicated that his estranged wife, Michelle, lived 10 miles away in Indiana, Pennsylvania, which I believe I played tennis in my freshman year of college at a different university, and we played Indiana University of Pennsylvania. So I might have been in that vicinity, Darren.
Oh, you very much well might have. I'm always curious about estranged. Like, is estranged like we were together, we don't talk anymore, but like it's not an active I'm keeping away? Or is estrangement like weird circumstances and we don't, like we haven't heard from each other in 15 years? Because living 10 miles away from your ex isn't like, the idea of being estranged feels weird to me. I don't know why, but it just doesn't come across as like that's what an estrangement should be.
Yeah, I agree. And honestly, the way people kind of, you know, the context around the word estranged can vary from place to place, you know?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, so a Blairsville police officer went to Michelle's home to give a notification of death. She was his next of kin, still, I guess, even being estranged. So Michelle seemed to be taken aback at hearing the news. So she told the officer she had just signed the couple's divorce papers and was ready to move on with her life, but wished her ex no ill will, which is what I kind of would assume. Blairsville police told Michelle that she had lost her husband. She seemed sad and shocked. Michelle agreed to help police in any way she could and tearfully opened up about the small town boy that had once stolen her heart. Oh, that's sweet. Michelle seemed completely in the dark about who could have committed such a horrible act, nor did she appear to have her own motive to kill him. The police began interviewing his friends and family, hoping to find out if John had made any obvious enemies. But police wondered if there was a neighbor or maybe a coworker that would have had some romantic relationship with John, because there's not really anything adding up. At least we don't know anything outside of Michelle. So yeah. After interviewing people close to John, none of them could identify even one person who wished ill upon him. And we all can think of one person that wishes ill upon us. You know, Matt right, can think of true. Several.
Yeah, sure.
As investigators continue to interview the residents, the appalling news of John's death sent shockwaves through the tight-knit community. And as expected, the town of Blairsville was in just belief, because nothing like this has ever happened mm-hmm. there or their lifetimes. And remember, there was no homicides there. Like,
right.
It didn't really happen. So yeah. Dennis Vaughn, a friend of John, remembers John saying, quote, "It was such a roller coaster of emotions on the day that I heard that John died. John was a larger than life person. And just how could he die? How could this happen?" It seems like John's relationship with his ex, Michelle, may have been the only one in his life that wasn't picture perfect. But even that had sort of been resolved, right? Mm-hmm, I mean, she seems to have no ill will, but had it really been resolved?
Yeah, but because maybe it hadn't. Yeah.
There's a lot more to, you know, relationships than we think. You know, you have sort of side A side B side, and then the truth. So there's kind of three sides to every story.
That's a good point, too. And yeah, like, they were divorced. So there's something to say about that, you know, in terms of not getting along or having some kind of issue.
Well, speaking of which, as investigators dig deeper and deeper, they discover that John and Michelle were in a pretty contentious divorce. So apparently John wanted nothing more than to be divorced from this woman. Interestingly, when John was killed, police found divorce papers scattered all around his body.
I thought that was such an interesting, like, image. Like, you know, it's almost like symbolic.
Makes me think of Seven. You know, that movie is like every killing is a sin. And so it's like, this is clearly symbolic. Michelle told police that she had signed the papers, but what detectives discovered next was kind of baffling. The documents necessary to get the divorce had not been signed by John. He was murdered the morning he was going to sign it. So, curious that the divorce papers were somehow connected to the murder, detectives looked deeper and deeper into this couple's past. How could you not?
Yeah, right. Well, they had met in 1996 when he was just 29 years old. Michelle was a 25-year-old, very attractive, kind of statuesque woman with piercing blue eyes. A friend of Michelle said, quote, "She was the local Budweiser girl, literally passing out Budweiser samples at the bar on the corner. A friend of his fixed them up. From what I understood, he was smitten," end quote.
Well, who doesn't love a Budweiser girl?
I need to find this picture, but I have a picture of me being held by a Budweiser girl when I was like 5 years old.
Is that why you're gay?
Why I'm gay.
The boobs so repulsed you, you can't even say the word vagina now, John?
Exactly. That's how I became a gay man. Yep.
Yeah, I think that is how it happens, if I'm not correct. Yeah, yeah, okay.
Well, that's how gay people are made. What can I say?
Right.
But yes, just a year into the relationship, John received heartbreaking news. He had found out that his mother had cancer, and it obviously devastated him. He was beside himself as his mother's health began to decline. But Michelle helped him take care of her, drawing the couple even closer. It seemed John had found not just the love of his life, but a family to adore as well, because Michelle had two children from a previous marriage. So John had his family basically instantly with her.
That's nice. John,
yeah, that's a nice little setup.
Or can be nice, yes.
Can be. John's cousin Marianne remembers the happiness of this all, saying, quote, "He was thrilled to be getting these two young children because he was a kid at heart and he loved to do all the things that kids like to do," end quote. Kind of like me. I'm a John who loves like Avengers and Jurassic Park and Harry Potter. Yeah, very similar.
Yeah, being swept up in Budweiser girls' arms.
Budweiser girls, that's true too.
Casual.
But swept up in their newfound love, John and Michelle made a decision, and in July of 1997, they became engaged. Family members thought that John wanted his mom to not worry about him, given that he was the only child. You know, his mom was basically, you know, dying of cancer, and, you know, for him, it was sort of this symbolic decision, like, hey, don't worry about me, I have my wife and my family now.
Right, exactly. That he was going to be taken care of in some way.
Exactly. And of course, his dad died, unfortunately, when he was an infant in a car accident. So he kind of grew up without his own father. And on New Year's Eve of that year, they went to Las Vegas and got married. But not everyone thought the relationship would have a fairy tale ending. In fact, for the short time they'd been dating, some close to John were concerned Michelle was getting too close too soon. Senior Deputy Attorney General John Krasick noted that during the investigation, none of John's friends and families really seemed to like Michelle. They saw her as someone who was trying to get his money, and they were very suspicious of her. Their concern, and their concern only deepened when John's mother finally passed away in June 1997, leaving her entire estate and a $1 million life insurance policy to her only child.
Wow. Well, I mean, to be fair, though, I feel like Michelle would have had to known that fact, maybe, to be after his money. So it's possible she didn't know. It's possible.
That's possible, right? That's true.
Well, only days after his mom died, John and Michelle went and had a will drawn up, leaving, guess what, everything to Michelle. So John's friends could not understand what was happening. This is totally out of character for their friend. Investigators learned that cracks in the marriage began to appear almost immediately after John's mother's death when they moved into a house John had bought for his new family. Okay. Mm-hmm. Apparently, Michelle was not happy with the house they lived in Blairsville. And to please his new wife, John agreed to leave the hometown he loved. Always a risk in a relationship.
Definitely.
That is when John purchased a house in Indiana, Pennsylvania, about 20 miles away. It had a swimming pool, hot tub, and he lavished Michelle with jewelry and expensive clothes, according to investigators. John seemed pretty happy to give his wife everything that she wanted, but one thing was crucially missing. John began talking about wanting a child of his own, and they began trying to have kids, but they were having difficulty conceiving. They ended up doing a series of fertility treatments that John paid for, which were extremely expensive. Nothing was working. Despite the setback, though, John was determined to have a baby with Michelle. So in March of 2002, years after the marriage, John and Michelle adopted a baby from Russia. John's dream of becoming a father had finally come to fruition. Friends and family said it was the happiest they had ever seen him. But soon the pressures of married life started to creep in, and the couple started bickering. The Bickersons, if you will. That's what I like to say when couples bicker a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was clear to their friends, to their family, to people who were around them that two of them were just not happy, or at least as happy as they seemed before, let's say. So 2 years later, Michelle told John she had had enough. Michelle told John that he would soon be receiving a phone call from a woman telling him that Michelle had been having an affair with the woman's ex-husband.
Oh, just very casual. Hey, you're going to get a phone call soon.
That's a little bizarre to me.
Definitely. And I mean, I just can't help but like feel so terrible for him because he lost his dad. He lost his mom. He's just trying to sort of, you know, create a normal life here. His friends are like, oh, he's the happiest he's ever been with this new child. Like, he just seems like such a like big hearted kind of guy, you know, like I don't know what he looks like. I know nothing more about this man than what we're talking about. But I get like very positive good vibes about who he was as a person.
Yeah, it seems, I mean, I think it's really sweet that he wanted another kid and, you know, when you're willing to adopt, and that's very nice.
Yeah, totally. Well, Michelle admitted that she was having an affair. Family and friends recalled the revelation being very devastating to John, of course. But John had also been kind of keeping secrets of his own. John's friend Dennis recalls saying, quote, early on in his relationship with Michelle, he himself had had an affair that he had never told Michelle about, end quote. John thought that by telling Michelle about his affair now, it would give him a foundation to move forward with understanding and love. So, yeah, you know, whenever you start having these problems in relationships, sometimes everything kind of comes out of the wash, so to speak. And it kind of puts everybody maybe back at a ground zero, but I don't know if that's always a good tactic, necessarily, because Michelle did not react positively to this news, saying, quote, how dare you have an affair on me?
Wow.
He told Michelle that it was a brief affair with a younger unmarried woman in town. Michelle became extremely upset. Remember, Michelle is telling him she's having an affair, but she's upset now that he was having an affair.
Well, to be fair, Michelle's also saying he's getting a phone call saying that she's having an affair, which seems like a very odd thing to say. They can't get over it.
Right. Well, Michelle became extremely upset and angry and demanded that he leave the house. And of course, being a family man, he didn't want to disrupt the children, so he left, which I thought was such a an amazing little detail there.
Yeah.
It was the start of a bitter separation that dragged through multiple court battles as the couple inched towards divorce. The affair and all the problems that came along with it had investigators wondering if this led to John's murder. Detectives called in John's divorce lawyer for questioning, but even more revealing was what the attorney told police about the couple's squabbles over money, which all started when John rewrote his will to give Michelle his $2 million estate. As it turned out, at the time of the murder, the divorce settlement was nearly finalized, but Michelle stood to lose out on a big chunk of her monthly alimony payments from John. This is where it gets interesting. Michelle had signed the divorce documents, but continually called his dental practice, he was a dentist, yelling that she needed more money and that she just needed more money, more money. Michelle's payments were about to plummet, and oddly, it was all because her new boyfriend, a state trooper named Kevin Foley, had just moved in with her. So apparently in Pennsylvania, alimony is not allowed when two people are cohabitating together. So because Michelle was living with her new boyfriend, she was going to lose a huge chunk of that $4,200 a month that John was paying her. And like, damn, $4,200 a month is a lot of money.
Well, I mean, it's definitely rent in Manhattan, but it's also,
I know, right?
Certainly,
I was
if you have kids,
too.
You know, it's also not that much in terms of it can go a long way, and it also can go by very, very quickly. But interesting rule in Pennsylvania that when two people are cohabitating together, you can't get alimony.
Yeah, and it was now clear to detectives that Michelle did have a motive for murder, but what evidence could link her really to that crime? The answers could lie in the bloody shoe prints or the trace evidence of DNA being analyzed at the crime lab, but until that had been resolved, investigators needed to interview everyone who may have come into contact with John, including Michelle's new boyfriend, Kevin Foley.
This sounds almost like contact tracing with what we're doing with COVID. You know, like you spoke to this person, true. Then you spoke to these people, but hopefully we'll get
this
solved. What
did you give this person? Yeah,
exactly. Well, Foley was a state trooper, and he told police he was playing hockey with friends on the night of the murder. But as the interview was wrapping up, the investigator officer noticed something unusual. As the interview was unwrapping up, the investigating officers noted that there was a 1-inch gash above Foley's eye. Knowing that there was a struggle in the house, the investigator attempted to make the connection. However, he did say he was playing hockey. Hockey is, you know, injury-prone type of sport. But the officer really wasn't convinced at this. So the officer immediately went to the district attorney and asked for a search warrant for Foley's blood. But he said he didn't think there was enough probable cause to do that. As a Pennsylvania state trooper, Kevin Foley was a trusted member of the police force. His fellow officers were reluctant to say anything that might cast Foley in a negative light. But after some prodding, surprising pictures started to emerge. Apparently, Kevin Foley made threats about John and would tell anybody he saw unprovoked that he hated him. That's pretty strong. Troopers told police they thought his comments were harmless. They had seemed like a boyfriend blowing off steam, but now in the light of John's murder, they took a little bit more of a sinister character. And, you know, we talk about this often, about how, you know, there's a difference between being like, oh my God, I'm going to kill Matt for not being here. And then sort of like always unsolicited saying, you know, like, I fucking hate Matt so much. Right. You know, like,
which we do a lot of, let's be honest.
Well, we have both. And we don't necessarily, is Matt here because he's alive and not here, or because we killed him? And we'll never really fully know the answer. Know. The good news is no one cares about Matt.
But so, no, you make a great point about this, though, because it's like, how do these, you know, we've said this before on the show, maybe if this is redundant to some listeners, but there are, what are we at now, 200 some episodes of us literally saying that about Matt? And like, would that be used against us in a court where we were obviously not the actual killers? You know what I mean?
Well, it's definitely just weird interesting. To think. Yeah, it is interesting. And, you know, I mean, obviously we say it in a joking sense, but what is that line of joking and then becoming more sinister?
Exactly,
so,
yeah.
Allegedly, Kevin, would walk into a shift at work and ask people how they were doing before quickly saying, I wish John Jelinek was dead, I wish he died, or I hate John Jelinek. That's pretty specific and a little bit, I mean, usually you got to get a drink or two in me before I say that about Matt. I'm not coming in, you know, guns a-blazing into the podcast saying that.
The other thing I think we have to say here, though, too, is that remember, Kevin is saying this about his girlfriend's ex-husband. So that's a very different scenario than like you and I talking about Matt. Although Matt did stay with you and you have baby Tersh. It's a very different kind of context.
No, it 100% is. And I think the weird thing about this is, like, why would a record state trooper just feel so much hatred for this seemingly mild-mannered guy named John? I mean, was it just jealousy over Michelle? Or yeah. had John done something to provoke him? Because for me, like, that's a lot of jealousy. Like, an ex is an ex for a reason, you know? So to be so harping on this ex just seems like a waste of time, because you can't really erase your past. So to find out what was behind Foley's deep suspicion, police again turned to John's divorce lawyer, and what she told them was staggering.
Yeah, well, the divorce lawyer said that Michelle had accused him of physically hurting the child. This, we're talking about John now, and of mentally abusing the child. And apparently, before John was murdered, she dropped a bomb that John had sexually abused the child.
Oh, that's a big allegation, and that's definitely warranted for hatred, no doubt.
And as a result, an agency that investigates child abuse had attempted to look into the allegations. The local police went to the office where he works while he was working on a patient. Remember, he's a dentist. And took him out in handcuffs.
Oh, Lord.
John denied the allegations, backed by his friends and family, and said that he was just thankful that his mother wasn't alive, because this would have killed her.
Oh, God.
Friends and family were disgusted by the allegations, saying that they were totally false and that he was not that type of person or capable of doing anything like that. John had done everything possible to prove his innocence, including lie detector tests, which he passed easily. Investigators eventually landed on the fact that the charges were just ultimately unfounded. The judge and family court talked to the child individually, and it became clear that this didn't happen. Eventually, the charges were thrown out as being completely unbelievable.
You know, it's impossible sort of to prove your innocence, which is why it's innocent until proven guilty in this country. But I also think him being walked out of his own practice in handcuffs, you know, anyone can accuse anyone of anything, but... And even though he was eradicated, you know, and vindicated, certainly, and said that he was innocent, the embarrassment that you can feel just from that, and think, you know, it's hard to erase those allegations against you, even if you're innocent. That's why I'm just so careful with words. And it's really important to, you know, really mean what you say and not just throw around these flagrant words, because they matter and they can really affect someone's life.
Yeah, you make such great points there, because, yeah, I mean, anyone can say anything. And obviously, these weren't just casual allegations. Right. These were very intense ones. And I love that the family court judge actually spoke to the child individually. I think that really says a lot about that judge. But one person seemed convinced of his guilt, though, and that was Michelle's boyfriend, Kevin. And he had ties deep within the investigation. When Michelle had made the allegations, it was the state police that would investigate. And not only that, it was Kevin Foley's colleague on the state police who ran the investigation. So
that
now
seems
he's tied
a little
up.
Suspicioso to me.
Yes, just a touch, right? After John was exonerated of child molestation charges, Kevin Foley asked his colleague on the state police to launch a second investigation.
Looking for more of the true crime content you crave? From Snap to Buried in the Backyard to Unsolved Mysteries, NBC Universal's new streaming service, Peacock, has you covered.
You guys know how much Darren and I love true crime docs. You could hear it in her voice just then. And Peacock has so many awesome programs. I'm a huge fan of shows like Snapped and Killer Couples. Getting to binge the hell out of them makes being alone in my haunted house just so much more enjoyable, Darren.
I'm thankful for that, because your haunted house absolutely terrifies me, John. But to our fans who listen to all of our episodes back to back, you're going to love this service, I promise. They've got a whole true crime channel that just plays endless crime shows. You're never going to run out of awesome content. Plus, more importantly, it's free.
I can't believe that it's free. That's the best part. On Peacock, you can stream your favorite shows or check out one of the many always-on channels, which are my favorite things, to get your true crime fix. Learn more at peacocktv.com.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
And in a second investigation, nothing was found. So despite the evidence, Kevin's hatred for John seemed somewhat unwavering. And when you think about what he's saying about him, oh, I want him dead, et cetera, and then also asking for an additional investigation, you're starting to get the picture here of what Kevin Foley's affinity towards this guy was, right?
Well, yeah, because he has a conclusion and now he's going to work backwards from it to prove it, which is always not the way to do it.
But while Blairsville detectives quietly believe that Kevin had a motive to murder John, a search of Kevin and Michelle's house turned up no evidence. So they weren't unable to really kind of connect him to any of the crime scene at this point. But then the results of the coroner's report came in and gave investigators what they hoped would help them catch their killer.
Well, the autopsy concluded the attacker used a sharp, smooth, double-edged knife to kill. And adding to the evidence, during his autopsy, the forensic pathologist found genetic material underneath John's fingernail.
Aha.
And, you know, when back when we were discussing, like, people kind of going into the crime scene, seeing the blood spatter, seeing the shoe prints. I often think about sort of what's left behind and underneath the fingernail to find out, you know, was there a fight? Did they get some of the DNA of the killer on there? Like, a lot of things can tell a story, even if you don't think that they can.
Was there a fight? Was there a scratch? Was there a gash? Let's find out.
Well, investigators determined that the kind of DNA testing they needed was beyond the scope of the state crime lab. Without more resources, they couldn't really analyze the evidence. Now it was 11 months into the investigation, and Blairsville police didn't have the evidence to charge anyone. Eventually, a year goes by, and there's still just no charges. But then John's cousin Marianne convinced the district attorney to let the attorney general's office take over the case. It was a very highly unusual but pivotal move in this, in certainly in this instance.
Yeah, and I mean, how amazing is this? Like, a family member was just not willing to give up on this.
Yeah,
totally her discretion. And she's like, come on, let's fucking get this going. I'm not just going to let him die in vain. Like, we're going to figure this out. I love that.
Yeah, I mean, you never underestimate the will of certainly of one person, because they can change so much. I mean, even what we've just seen of these, you know, just when you look at unsolved mysteries, you look at the Golden State Killer, you look at so many family members who, when the police and the court systems were willing to give up, the family completely turned around a case, even though it took much longer.
Yeah.
And in February of 2007, the Attorney General's office began leading the criminal investigation. Now, the new team on the case reviewed the crime scene photos and autopsy report. Then they used the evidence to recreate the knife attack. It was clear that the attacker pushed him against the glass panel beside the front door. His head smashed through it. Krastick discovered that the scene was brutal, saying it broke the glass. John Yelenik's throat, his neck is caught, creating a jagged neck wound. Whoever the attacker was at that point took the knife and sliced across the neck of John Yelenik. Horrible way to die in some weird way. This reminds me of, you've seen Ghost, right?
A long time ago, what happened in that? Was there something connected to this?
Well, yeah, that how I'm blanking on his name, but he's in Scandal, the main guy. I know him, Tony, whatever his name is. I'll look it up.
Okay, yes,
yes. How he dies in the when a window's coming down and it like smashes his whole. It's just it's brutal.
Yeah,
it's Tony Goldwyn is his name. But Kevin Foley was strong enough to really pull this off. He's a 6'2" triathlete and marathon runner. And although he was a respected trooper, he was also described as having an edge to him. Krastic described Foley saying, "I saw Kevin Foley as almost a quintessential bully, a talk down to everybody. He seemed to really enjoy being a state trooper. If you were a bully, that would be a good job to have. And he certainly filled that role." I mean, even just the aggressive manner of him saying, you know, "I want this guy dead. I hate this guy. John Jelinek sucks." Like, that's a very aggressive demeanor to have.
Well, definitely. I think at this point, though, too, we should mention that just being an athlete and having a shitty personality doesn't make one a murderer either,
no.
You know?
No, so God, no. It just makes him more viable to at least pull this off physically.
Exactly. At least they know that all those checkboxes are getting checked,
right?
Basically. Well, the evidence started to mount against Kevin because investigators also learned that he had a fondness for knives.
Oh.
Okay.
All right. Hmm.
There are reports that he would walk around the barracks flipping his knives open and closed over and over again, but all efforts to find a murder weapon had failed. Remember, yeah, he was stabbed with a double-edged knife over and over again, so they were definitely looking for the murder weapon. And remember the bloody shoe print? Well, the bloody shoe print at the crime scene remained the strongest physical evidence, but investigators needed help identifying them. So they went straight to the top. The FBI crime lab agreed to look for a match in their database of prints.
Thank you.
And this isn't. Yeah, right. And this is another example of, like, I thought that's just what happened. Like, I didn't realize that they had to go and request. You know what I mean? Like, I just assume all this stuff is, like, we're all on the same team. We're all on the same databases. It doesn't really occur to me, or I guess I'm still learning that, like, yeah, you have to go and request this from the FBI. It's not just available to everyone.
No, I think it's impressive, though, that they have a database of prints.
For sure. That's amazing. They discovered that the shoe was very clearly an Asics Gel Creed Plus tennis athletic shoe.
So it's you, John.
It's me. It's gotta be. I'm a tennis player. Clearly me. And the size was between a size 10 and a 12.5, and I fit that description as well.
That seems like a huge discrepancy, though, for, like, to know, like, 10 and 12.5? I mean, that seems like
a couple inches
difference. Maybe I'm wrong, but, like, that, as narrow as that gap seems, it also seems kind of big.
I thought about this, too. I love that you're saying this, because when I was looking through the research, I paused and had the same kind of reaction.
Right.
The only thing I can think of is, like, maybe the print of the shoe isn't necessarily as big or as small as the 10 to 12-inch actual shoe, if that makes sense.
No, I don't know. That's a good guess. Take a drink of your water.
Okay, I will take a drink in a second. But anyway, these men's shoes were the only prints from the crime scene, so investigators could conclude that Michelle wasn't there, which I think is very interesting in and of itself. I mean, a woman could wear a men's shoe. Like, that doesn't mean Michelle wasn't there. Yeah, there you go. And men can wear women's shoes, too. You should see my collection of high heels. Anyway.
Yes. Oh, we've seen them, sweetie.
I'm just teasing. That's where Megan should chime in about Rocky Horror Picture Show, but anyway.
I am the Hamburglar.
You are the Hamburglar after all. Anyway, they realized that the brand of shoe, this is where it gets very interesting, that they discovered there was a program with Asics and law enforcement.
Interesting.
Law enforcement, Darren, would get a discount for purchases of their sportswear. And guess who was one of their best customers?
Pick me.
Go ahead, Darren.
Who is Kevin Foley for $1,000?
Correct. You win $1,000. And guess what one of his purchases was, Darren? They were able to determine it was a pair of size 10 Asics Gel Creed Plus athletic shoes. So, okay, here we are. We were able to now match a purchase from Kevin with the shoes found at the crime scene. Well, listen, you know, I have a pair of tennis shoes that I'm sure many, many, many other tennis players are wearing anytime they're on the court. You know, it's not like there's an endless amount of tennis shoes necessarily. But Darren, not only that, investigators were even able to find photos of Kevin wearing the exact type of shoe.
I literally just Google imaged the shoe because now I want to make sure that it's not you. And I can safely confirm I haven't seen you wearing shoes at all.
I don't wear Asics, so there you
go. Shade.
There you go.
I don't wear Asics. Not shade.
No, no, no. I'm just saying I just don't. I have a particular type of shoe I like. Yeah.
I agree.
Anyway, colleagues of his even noticed that he would always wear Asics shoes when he was working out until the murder. And then, Darren, he switched to Nike shoes.
Oh, hell no. You don't switch from Asics to Nike. You always stay on Nike. Come on.
Right. It makes me well. I'll save my thought I have right now for later on in the show. But
well, detectives return to one of the most important elements of any investigation: the alibi, which, as you remember, he said he was playing hockey with friends the night of the murder. Investigators knew that John was killed around 1 a.m. after Foley's game would have been clearly over unless this was an insane game. The strongest evidence of all could have been collected by John himself, though, when he dragged his fingernails across the killer's skin and picked up some DNA. Now, with the FBI in the case, they did what local investigators didn't have the resources to do: analyze the DNA from under the fingernails. And the test results came back, and as it turns out, a very small percent of the DNA under his fingernails belonged to somebody else, presumably the attacker here. The analysis was enough to arrest Kevin Foley. In September of 2007, after a 17-month investigation, Kevin Foley was finally charged with the murder of John. Following his arrest, he was suspended from his job as a state trooper without pay, according to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Yay! Thank God that actually worked out. But prosecutors still have the difficult task of convincing a jury that a 13-year police veteran was guilty of such a heinous crime. Because how could a police officer be guilty of such a heinous crime?
Right. They're a different type of person, apparently.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, I mean, we've learned now, especially on this show, that anybody, including best friends, can be your killer in the long run.
Yes.
I will say, though, I do want to say one thing. It's like, okay, they're able to connect the DNA under his fingernail did not belong to him and it belongs to someone else. At this point, they don't have John's DNA yet, or at least not in the research I was looking for, to connect him specifically. So to me, I find it kind of crazy that they were able to kind of arrest him. I'm wondering if this went to a grand jury. You know, there's no detail about that, but I just find it so crazy that there's just other DNA under his skin, so it must be John Foley at this point. I find that very odd.
Well, yeah, because that doesn't seem conclusive. I mean, switching sneakers, like, all of that is very, it's correlational, right. And I definitely think there's something to it, but at the same time, like, that does not prove to me in a court of law just because this guy started switching shoes, you know?
Exactly. And that was the point I was going to make that I was saying I was saving. But anyway, and when the trial began, finally, one person was noticeably absent, Michelle. She was not charged in connection with her husband's death, and she always maintained that she had nothing to do with the murder. Kevin Foley took the stand for his own defense with 4 hours of testimony.
Oh my God.
Yeah, 4 hours of testimony is a lot. To take the stand with your own defense is kind of crazy. Not a lot of cases, especially murder cases, that happen.
Well, there was this like fake, sorry to interrupt, but maybe there was this fake confidence of him being a state trooper that he could beat the system in a way. Yeah.
Maybe. Well, he also spoke about how he recently adopted a baby boy from Guatemala, calling it the best time of his life, according to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Lots of adoptions happening up there in Pennsylvania. That's nice to hear.
Yes, that is.
But he, Kevin Foley, vigorously proclaimed his innocence. On the stand, he said that he would sometimes jokingly say he wished that John would die in a car crash, with prosecutors asking, what's funny about that? He would go on to say that it's, quote, just his personality. This is all according to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporting of the trial.
But that's so, like, that's, like, too dark. Like, I just hope that guy dies in a car crash. You're like, whoa, That's, like, you know, like, that's a little much.
Yeah, it's a bit much. And then it was the prosecution's turn to present their case. They hoped that the DNA evidence would be the nail in Foley's coffin. There was a match between the DNA found under the fingernails of John and the DNA of Kevin. So
boom.
Now...
drop mic, John.
There you go. Now there is conclusive evidence, but the defense debunked the findings, calling in their own DNA expert, who then called the results inconclusive. Now, listen, we're not in the courtroom, we are not a part of this case, but to me, if you have another DNA expert come in and say it's inconclusive, I'm in my head, Darren, as I sit here speaking to you, I'm like, okay, well, that's weird. Like, I would want even more information about this, because if it's not his DNA,
whose DNA is it?
Then whose DNA is it? Exactly. So then there's still more to this case. And, you know, just to give Kevin Foley the benefit of the doubt here, you know, what if he is innocent? I mean, Darren, totally. You and I talk all the time about the Innocent Project, which you're a huge proponent for. This is the kind of sequence that unfolds in courtrooms that puts people behind bars that maybe aren't actually the killer. You know what I mean?
I agree. And, you know, it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, and there's reason for that.
Exactly. Well, prosecutors were left wondering if the evidence would be enough to put John's killer behind bars. The jury deliberated for 6 hours, leading the family to wonder if their loved one's killer was about to get off scot-free. You know, the longer the debate, I guess, the more
unanimous it is. Yeah, right.
Well, a hush fell over the courtroom as the jury prepared to deliver the verdict. It was unanimous. State Trooper Foley was guilty of first-degree murder just after 10 p.m. that day, according to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Kevin Foley was sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole.
Wow.
According to reports, on the day that Kevin was sentenced to life in prison, Michelle packed up a truck with all of her belongings and drove to Savannah, Georgia, where she still resides. Michelle raised their adopted son without his father or his father's family. He is now a young adult. So,
wow.
I don't know. To me, I'm a little bit skeptical. I mean, life in prison without the possibility of parole when there was allegedly inconclusive DNA evidence. I mean, yes, there's plenty of circumstantial evidence here, but I don't know. To me, if I'm one of those jurymen, I'm not sure I would have voted guilty. Although,
possibility of parole. I mean, I think for me, the interesting thing about Michelle is she can claim innocence all she wants. She didn't maybe put the knife to her ex, for sure. I'm not saying there was physical things there, but like accusing her ex of doing all these horrible things to their children, and then sort of putting in their mind to Kevin, horrible. I hope that she's living a life of just guilt trips over and over again. I mean, you know, you can't arrest something like that, but I hope this heavily weighs on her, especially as a fucking mom.
Right. And, you know, now that the son is an adult, you have to wonder how he has processed all of that.
Exactly.
You know? There's a lot going on there.
Exactly.
And then, I mean, even to me, like if I'm in Kevin's shoes, I'm kind of like, what is the motive exactly? Like, okay, like you've heard these horrible things that are alleged that were completely unfounded about, you know, the ex. What is so important that you have to then go risk your life and your career as a state trooper to kill? You know what I mean? To me, the motive with like the DNA inconclusivity, I don't know. It just all added up to a very...
We can't package this one up in a bow, in a nice bow.
There you go.
That's for sure.
That's a great way to put it. Well, let us know what you guys think on social media, at Jay Thrasher, at Carpe Darren, at Matt the Bartender. And let us know what you think about this episode and if you tend to agree with what we were saying.
Yeah, I'm curious what you guys all think out there. Should we end on a positive note? Something we can wrap in a bow with some listener shout-outs.
Yes, why don't you take the first one, Darren?
Sure. Well, Jordan from our recent Instagram Live this past week said, got a couple questions answered from my favorite podcasters at Carpe Darren and at Jay Thrasher from @martinis_murder. This week via their Instagram Live, and my birthday month is already awesome. Keep crushing the game. Grateful for all the laughs and go easy on Matt. He's kind of cute. All right. Jordan, you and I need to have a conversation separately. You know what? Happy birthday to you, but you really killed my birthday, and that's not even until May by saying that Matt's cute. That's all I'm going to say.
I actually wanted to bring this up because I found it very disturbing that Jordan would say such things.
You
about
haven't
Matt.
Been able to sleep, I've heard. Like, you've been going on 2 hours of sleep a night.
I'm like, Jordan, why don't you think I'm cute? I don't know. It's just weird.
Right, or me, Jordan.
Yeah, or Darren for that matter. Yeah. Well, Cortland on Twitter, which is a really cool name. I like that name.
Yeah, me
Cortland.
Too.
She says this on Twitter. I'm so addicted to martinis and murder. I've literally listened to 30 episodes in like 5 days.
Whoa.
Courtland, listen, we know it's quarantine time. We're trying to stay away from people. I just can't fathom doing, like, what is that? Like 6 episodes per day of us talking and just being ridiculous. That just does not work for me. I can't imagine that ever happening.
Courtland, well, I guess it could be a female or male.
I think it's a female, yeah.
Courtland didn't say whether or not Matt was cute, so Courtland's still beating Jordan in this game.
Yes. That's okay. Right.
We like Courtland. Yes.
We like Courtland. Yes, exactly.
Right. Well, thanks so much for listening, guys. We will be back on Thursday with another shot and a full case on Sunday. We all hope that you have a very great week.
Yes. And by the way, Thursday, Megan, cut this out. I was going to say listen to my strip washing thing, but that was last Thursday, technically. So, Megan, cut this out. And I'll see you guys next time.
Bye.
Bye. Purple's papaya that's going to be tough. Sorry. Megan's going to do some editing. Okay, let me try it again. Purple's proprietary technology.
Purple's proprietary. It's tough.
I got it right, and then I started laughing. Sorry. One more time. For a limited time, you'll get 10% off any order. Oh, my God.
Are you taking a walk today?
That is my Alexa telling me to take a walk today.
Oh, my God.
Oh, here's the weather. Perfect.
Hmm. Tonight's forecast.
For fuck's sake.
Can you turn this off?
Sorry. It's done now. Sorry. It does this every day at 10 till 6. My apologies.
All good.
One more time. Well, Megan, we really fucked that one up for you.